So today I want to talk to you about my current research project. As Yoey said, it's a history of Soviet zoos. I'll definitely focus on Moscow and Leningrad, as there's more than enough to work on with these two main Soviet zoos. I might even end up focusing on Moscow alone. I'm not sure. When I started out, I envisioned this, of course, I think we all do this massive, massive project, and I was going to do zoos from all over the Soviet Union from 1917 to 1991. And then, you know, the grant applications would go out and comments would be, oh, I really think this is too wide. And I'm like, what do you know? And then I would talk to, like, my colleagues and, you know, the pre-revolutionary people would be like, oh, you can't start in 1917. You got to start in the 19th century. You got to go to the present day. And so, you know, I have all these wild ideas. And then, you know, start to do the research and you realize that just how much is there. And I think that in some ways, if I do a history of Moscow, I do want to do some on Leningrad. And interestingly enough, the Leningrad Zoo is still the Leningrad Zoo. They wouldn't change their name because their argument was that their experiences in the siege of Leningrad in the Second World War were such a defining moment for them as an institution that they won't change their name from Leningrad, the Leningrad Zoo. So that's kind of interesting and figures sort of relates to the story in terms of zoos in wartime, because Leningrad, as you can imagine, has a spectacular story. So, in light of my research this summer, I think I'll probably stop in 1964 now, the end of the Khrushchev years, partly because of laws on privacy and so on. We'll see. We can talk more about issues later if you want to talk about the chronology and the time frame. And of course, from the beginning, the ideas, the project's been evolving and changing over time. So my first research trip a couple of years ago was a kind of reconnaissance trip, and I thought I'd focus on looking at the materials generated by the Leningrad and the Moscow zoos in the Second World War. I wanted to see what kind of materials existed for this kind of study. Would it be just an article? Would it be something more than that? And very quickly, I realized that there's so much material here. A book-length project was easily in the vision. So as I've conceived of it so far, I want to do the following. I want to, one, briefly look at the prehistory of zoos and animal collection in Imperial Russia. Perhaps look at zoos in moments of crisis, 1905, 1917, the civil wars. And if we look at zoos in moments of crises, does that give us a new angle through which to understand and approach these pivotal moments that we've looked at in the historiography in other ways? One thing that really struck me when I started working through the materials was the emphasis. And it's not surprising when you really think about it, but it was interesting that zoo directors in their reports felt obliged to emphasize the difference between a socialist zoo and a capitalist zoo. And so I found it very interesting. How do they do this? How do they conceive of, how do they present the notion that they're a socialist zoo? And the real emphasis is that capitalist zoos are about entertainment and socialist zoos are about education. And that brings us into very interesting territory because the zoo was under pressure to be a place of study. So to be a laboratory, to be biological. All of the zoo directors until the present director is the first director of the Moscow Zoo who's not a biologist. So it's a very kind of interesting emphasis on science and on producing scientific results. One of the things that was interesting to me also was how does this play out in the context of the Cold War? And how do the goals of the zoo reflect this tension with the West and the forging of a Soviet institutional identity over time? And how you create this image, how you basically pitch your institution to the administration and to higher sources of resources so that you can get resources for your institution. And that became something that I became very, very interested in because a lot of times, particularly in wartime, but you're dealing with a society where resources are short. And how you appeal for resources becomes very interesting if you're successful, if you're good at it. The administration of the Moscow Zoo was purged in 1937, and I would like to document this set of purges. What does it reveal about the zoo? Does it give us, again, a new angle on a moment of crisis? I know the material is there. I haven't seen it yet. Hopefully I will. It requires certain appeals and pitches to the director of the city archive, because they just took the whole year of 1937 and took it out of the, put it in a private like collection. And you have to go to the director and explain why you need to see 1937. So I'm still hoping that that will work, and it's pretty funny because I had a research assistant, and I'm like, why don't you go talk to him? And she's like, I'm not gonna talk to him. No, you go talk to him. You know, she was like completely like, no, I'm not gonna do that. So, but we'll see. Hopefully it'll work. It's interesting because the topic, and there's, we can maybe talk about this in question and answer too, is there's some tension here, because most people's initial reaction is, oh, you know, dobraya tema. Like, that's a really kind theme. Like, you're doing such a, you're gonna say nice things about the zoo. And I'm like, maybe not so nice, but we'll see, right? And then you feel bad. You don't want to play on that. At the same time, you don't want to like barge into the zoo and say, hey, I hate zoos, let me into the archive. But, I wouldn't do that in historical context either. I mean, it's very, these people who work there are really, most of them, very, very dedicated to this. They're interesting too, people who work in the zoos, the directors, the researchers. They're interesting because they are politically vulnerable. And they're politically vulnerable because they are part of an international community, right? You've got, there's kind of a world of zookeepers and zoo directors, and they're a strange community. And they, when you think about it, how many people, your monkey, one of your capuchins get sick, right? How many people can you call to ask how you're going to take care of this capuchin, right? And in the Soviet case, too, you can't just import the food these animals need, right? They have a food laboratory where they're constantly working on surrogates, like, what can we feed them? And what they feed them changes over time as they learn. And the 1920s are so interesting because the primates are eating exactly what the people working with them are eating, right? So in the morning, you get a piece of bread and sweet tea. And at lunch, you get sweet tea and a piece of bread. And, you know, like, it's interesting. I mean, it's how they keep the animals alive at all is quite an accomplishment. Looking at the zoo has opened up so many areas for me that hadn't occurred to me to exist. So one of the things, too, is that, I'm going to drink some water, is that trapping animals, for exhibition, how do you do that, right? So being a socialist zoo, well, they have to decide, right? Are we a socialist zoo? Are we a nationalist zoo? Should we only exhibit the animals of the Soviet Union? Of course, that didn't go over. It was like, no. We want to be like all the other big zoos in the world. We want one of everything, and we want to exhibit Soviet animals. So, okay, so some zoos, the zoos that keep their animals alive, that have the highest rate of success, not surprisingly, are zoos that only do local animals, right? So I think it's the Kirov Zoo has a really good rate of survival because they don't have elephants and they don't have monkeys and, you know, things that need warmth and tropical fruit, right? Things that are hard to come by in the Soviet Union. But what was interesting is that there are these zoo bases, and they exist in isolated locales across the Soviet Union, and they're set up to purchase native wildlife. So people are encouraged to like trap animals and bring them to the zoo base and get paid for doing it. And I found that interesting because this is almost a kind of private exchange, right? This is a bit of a capitalist transaction, and revealing and kind of depressing too, because if you read the instructions to trappers, they're like, we will not take animals that have broken limbs. We will not take animals that are so traumatized that they're going to die in 24 hours. And so you get a sense of what it means to trap these animals and bring them to the zoo base. As I mentioned before, the zoos were scientific research stations. Some of you may be familiar with Mikhail Mikhailovich Zavadovsky, who was the director of the Moscow Zoo in the mid-1920s, and he took over that position. And of course, the politics of who is the zoo director is so interesting, right? And people like jockeying against each other in terms of scientific, academic standing and academic trends and you know, sort of painting your opponent in the, whatever the negative language of the time is, and people coming back from the past and coming back into the position. So that's all very, very interesting as it unravels as well. So Zavadovsky, just the interesting story about him, he was famous for doing sex reassignment in chickens and other birds, and had been persuaded to do some surgery on people too in the 1920s. I need to look more into that. But he gets a spot in the laboratory and in the zoo in 24. And then the zoo director, when he kind of hears what he's doing, and Zavadovsky's kind of funny because he sort of saw himself as Dr. Moreau. We talked about that. Like, that was his favorite book, and which made me a little nervous. And the director, Kotz, who he replaces, Kotz starts to go into the lab when he's not there and let the birds go because he doesn't want Zavadovsky to work on them. So there are all these stories that emerge from this. The zoos ran an organization, and they still do to the present day, all of these zoos. They're called CUBES, which is the circle for young biologists and zoologists. And it's an interesting organization because the membership included some of the major reformers of the Gorbachev era and beyond, for example. Alexei Yablokov, for example, who became president of Greenpeace in Russia and chief advisor to Yeltsin on the environment, was a member of CUBES. And so this story of zoo directors and researchers can be placed in this wider context of Soviet science, naturalists. And also, I think what I'm hoping that emerges from this is a nuanced understanding of a complex workplace environment. So workplace identities, intellectual communities, and social structures. The war material, which I'll move on to, is the part that I've done the most primary research on. And it really, I find, reveals a lot about human, non-human, animal relations, which is one of the topics that interests me as well. Zookeepers in World War II, for example, they moved into the zoos. They sacrificed everything to keep these animals alive. Why? It keeps them alive too, so there's a lot of that. There's a lot of kind of mutual dependence here. But the material also, I think, encourages us to interrogate our own often contradictory attitudes toward animals, and to understand animals in a human and historical context. So the project, in part, is motivated by questions raised by the relatively new field of human, non-human animal studies. And this new mode of inquiry and thinking, I think, rests uneasily alongside both environmental studies and history. I've always been drawn to what we call the history of the voiceless, social history, history from below, history of ordinary people who didn't necessarily leave a written record. And it began to occur to me that animals were the most voiceless historical actors that I could find. And the more I began considering animals as historical actors, the less I was inclined to eat them. The more I began to engage with some of this really rich emerging literature on animal studies, moving beyond older frameworks of biology and zoology. I thought it was going to time out on me. And incorporating them at the same time. And they're changing, there are shifts in biology as well, and a lot of tensions within disciplines now about this particular angle of inquiry. I began reading about how zoos around the world were affected by war, by reading the debates on zoos, for zoos, against zoos. And we have a number, we have many, many recent examples of animals caught up in human warfare. I will ask, can someone give me a you have 10 minutes left warning?
Yeah, but not for a while.
Okay, good, good. No, I know. I realize that I'm like looking at my, I'm like chatting.
We started late, so
okay.
No, you're fine.
All right, good. Because sometimes, I still remember this one time where I thought I was in the 20 minutes, and my friend Steve was like, you talked for 40 minutes. So give me a warning, like shut me up if need be. Okay, so animals in warfare. August 1990, Iraqi troops invade Kuwait and occupy the zoo. The birds, two leopards, three wolves, and orangutan were among animals shot by soldiers for fun. The gazelles were shot and eaten by hungry soldiers. Zebras were shot and fed to the lions because lions were hungry. Surviving elephant lived with a bullet in his leg that was never treated. Monkey's leg was shattered by a bullet. And the zoo was, quote unquote, liberated by US forces. This example brings up a host of questions, including the hierarchy that humans have regarding non-human animals. So the tension between, we have the recent case too of Marius, right, at the Denmark Zoo, the giraffe that, you know, someone offers to even buy him, and Denmark Zoo is like, no, we need to kill him, we want him out of the gene pool, and then we're gonna feed him to the predators, right? And everyone's like, what? And Marius is so cute. I had a picture of Marius before, and I don't have him out there. He's so cute. He's like, what do you think the predators eat? Right? They have to eat something. What's the difference between Marius or the cow from the slaughterhouse down the street, right? So, I mean, we have these really, really contradictory emotional responses, right? So who decides who lives and who dies, right? What animal is worthy of torment for entertainment purposes? What does it mean for U.S. forces to liberate a zoo? Soviet troops withdrew from Afghanistan in 1989. The Kabul Zoo became a battleground for rival factions fighting between 92 and 96. And the same thing, by the way, happens. The Moscow Zoo is at Krasnopresenskaya and is a site of fighting in 1905, 1917. There's just a lot of conflict there. So the buildings of the zoo in Kabul were shelled. Rabbits and deers were eaten by soldiers. Some soldiers dared a fellow soldier to enter the lion's den. The lion mauled him, and he was rescued when his friends threw a grenade at the lion, blinding him in one eye and completely traumatizing him. Another soldier fired a rocket-propelled grenade at an elephant for entertainment. And there was an international rescue effort, 2001 to 2002, but most of those agencies pulled out. Current state of the zoo is uncertain. In 2012, a Guardian article reported that the mayor of Kabul hopes to, quote, enlarge and improve the zoo. Which raises the question, why have zoos at all, right? What are zoos about? Upon reflection, they seem almost, they seem archaic in the 21st century, right? But why did every city that wanted to conceive of itself as a real city feel the need to have a zoo through the 20th century, from the 19th to the 20th century? And the answers to the question, I think, are closely linked to issues of imperialism, issues of modernity, urbanization, development, park spaces. And there's a lot that needs to be done there, too. Bosnian War, 1992, the animals of Sarajevo Zoo starved while the zookeepers who tried to feed them were felled with sniper's bullets. Catherine Denning of York University published a really interesting article in 2008, which she looks at Western coverage of the Baghdad Zoo in 2003 to show how stories on the zoo emphasized Western humanity and local inhumanity, right? So zoos become this tool in like so many other things, but in newspaper coverage and to emphasize humanity versus inhumanity. And again, it's just at the surface, right? Once you start to dive into the topic, the contradictions are really, really striking. So closer, a little closer to home for some of us, in early March of this year, the Kharkov Zoo made public the fact that the zoo animals were starving. And they appealed to the citizens of the city to rally behind the animals, who they said, quote, were the true patriots of our city, which is really interesting, right? So supplies, their suppliers had been providing them food on credit for months, and what was going on was that the city was just not paying the budgeted funds to the zoo. right? And this happens time and time again, because zoos are kind of this precarious thing, right? If your city's doing well and you know your city looks great and you want your zoo to look good, you send your money to the city to feed the zoo. But when things are chaotic, right, and the local government falls to new people and they're like, why are we feeding animals? Like, and you stop getting your money, right? And this happens time and time again. And in the Soviet case, it's so interesting because you see the pre-revolutionary organizers of the Moscow Zoo, this sort of what would be regarded pretty quickly as a bourgeois society, trying to save the zoo, right? So they're like, you know, we beg you, Soviet government, please nationalize our zoo. And they're like, do you want city jurisdiction or do you want, like, you want Soviet jurisdiction? Do you want to be under the Ministry of, or the Commissariat of Enlightenment? And they're like, ah, Soviet Commissariat of Enlightenment, please, like, that's where the money is. And then they're not getting money, right? So by 1921, they're like, please put us under city jurisdiction, where they've managed to find people within the city who want to support the zoo. So there's such interesting politics about, and arguments that you need to make in order to get your zoo off the ground. And it's people who are devoted to the zoo for whatever reason who do this, right? But so the Kharkov Zoo, they make this appeal, right? There's a massive public response. The citizens of the city flood the zoo with shopping bags full of oranges, apples, lettuce, cabbage. This is great. And then the zoo's like, whoa, stop, these are perishables, right? They're going to feed the animals for a week and then they're going to be rotten. We can't use them. So this is what like the public zoo response was, people coming into the zoo to bring food. And this is piles of food. Again, so people really, you know, people like animals, right? And they respond and they want to help. But that's a short-term solution. And the zoo needs a long-term solution. So more recently, I went through their website and they haven't made more appeals like this. They've fallen back on tried and true ways of raising funds. Adopt an animal to feed, come in and feed an animal, pony rides. And they've had like Dien Subotnikov. So they've had Saturday days where people from the city come in and clean up the zoo. The Kiev Zoo, 2011, numerous articles start appearing regarding the dire conditions in Kiev Zoo. News reports have been quiet for the past few months regarding the current situation, but Yanukovych had his own private zoo with thousands of animals that now face the possibility of starvation. And it's kind of interesting because when the animals started disappearing from the Kiev Zoo, they seemed to start appearing in Yanukovych's private zoo. But, you know, I haven't looked into that. So, but both Kiev, yeah. Both Kiev and Kharkov zoos were occupied by Hitler's armies. In the winter of 1943, Kharkov's three rhesus monkeys escaped the zoo and hid in an office at Gazprom. At one point, one of them was shot and wounded by a policeman who saw him racing around. And they spent months hiding in the attic of someone's house. They escaped Gazprom. They were returned to Gazprom, where employees hid them and protected them through the war. These three monkeys were the very few who survived the war years in Kharkov. So we have these really interesting situations with zoos and wartime and people giving resources to these animals to keep them alive, right? And again, this strange contradiction of why save these three monkeys? Why put all of these resources into it? Okay, so the bulk of my archival research, as I said, had focused on Moscow and Leningrad zoos during World War II. And my interest began when a colleague and a friend from graduate school introduced me to this book, to Diana Ackerman's Zookeeper's Wife. This is a novel appeared in 2007, based on the diaries of Antonina Zabinski, who had worked alongside her husband, Jan Zabinski, caring for the Warsaw Zoo when the Nazis invaded Poland. The Zabinski family hid and fed more than 300 Jews in zoo enclosures and cages, and in their home, helping them secure false documents to pose as Poles, helping them to find safe passage out of Poland. Some 30 people lived at the zoo for the entire war, people that they couldn't move. And out of that 300, only two people didn't survive the war. And Jan Zubinski, the head of the Warsaw Zoo, joined the resistance, hid caches of weapons at the zoo. He was wounded in the Polish uprising of August to September 1944, taken prisoner in Germany. And he was named director of the Warsaw Zoo in 29. And he held this position in 39 when the Nazis invaded Poland. And the zoo was severely bombed during the invasion. Some of the animals were killed in the bombing. Others escaped when their cages were destroyed. Lions and polar bears were shot by Polish soldiers in the street. And the scene was repeated in other cities during the Second World War where zoos were bombed, including Belgrade, where Kostirka's film Underground has scenes of animals wandering around the city, which actually happened. In the case of the Warsaw Zoo, German zoologists came and selected the animals that they deemed worthy of being transferred to German zoos by the end of December 1939. They believed that some Polish bison was like the Uber bison, the Uber cow, and so they wanted as many of the Uber cows as possible, which they took back and scattered in zoos around Germany. And when they were done, the local Gestapo got drunk and had a hunting party, driving around the zoo in a jeep and shooting animals in cages. So Zubinski was named superintendent of city parks because he was the head of the zoo. And in that capacity, he actually went in and out of the Warsaw ghetto, claiming that he needed scraps for the animals, it's amazing that they believed him. Like, why would you look for scraps of food in the Warsaw ghetto? But he did. He smuggled correspondence in and out of the ghetto. So during the Second World War, and so I became very interested. After reading this, I'm like, well, what happened in Russian zoos? Because Russia was my main area of interest. What are the stories there? And what happened in general? I wanted a general picture of zoos in wartime. So the Second World War, really interesting. The London Zoo euthanizes all its poisonous snakes and spiders in September 1939 in anticipation of the zoo being bombed. In Germany, soon after the outbreak of war, the military orders all lions, tigers, leopards, and bears in German zoos to be shot. And many zoos don't do it, though. They don't comply. Phosphorus bombs were dropped on the Hagenbeck Zoo near Hamburg in July 1943, and keepers shot animals so that they wouldn't die by burning. In Berlin, a concrete flak tower was built on the zoo grounds, stocked with food and ammunition, so it drew constant fire to the zoo. And that situation's not unlike the Leningrad Zoo, which is in the same place it's always been, next to an artillery base, next to a military base in St. Petersburg. British raids on Berlin in November 1943 killed 7 elephants, a rhinoceros, 2 giraffes, 2 gorillas, 15 primates, and most of the surviving animals were eaten by the citizens of the city, eaten by citizens in Berlin. And this is not uncommon. Same thing happens in the French Revolution. Animals in menageries are eaten. Veterinarians in Berlin were spent a week trying to butcher an elephant into edible cuts of meat. And the dead sound like the lucky ones, alongside descriptions of surviving animals who were often severely injured and slowly starving. In the summer of 1943, Tokyo City, Tokyo Prefecture were merged into Tokyo's metropolis, and the new governor ordered the slaughter of zoo animals to, quote, shock residents into understanding the severity of the threat of war. At a memorial for the animals held on the 4th of November 1943, school children were the target audience for a gathering in which high-ranking Tokyo officials described the animals as, quote, martyrs for the country. Top administrator for Tokyo Parks said to those who gathered, "I want you to think deeply about the severity of the situation that made such extraordinary measures necessary." And even while this memorial was being held, 2 of the zoo's 3 elephants were still slowly dying from starvation while the memorial was going on. And there's a new book by Ian Jared Miller looking at this incident, he does the history of the Tokyo Zoo, but his central focus is this incident to try and explain why this happens the way it does and what the zoo means in Tokyo and what the zoo animals were what their suffering was used to try and convey to the citizens of the city. In the US, zoo animals also suffered in World War II. In 1942, the superintendent of the Boston Zoo offered his primates to other zoos because he couldn't afford to keep their cages at temperatures that they needed to survive. No zoo would take them, so all of the primates were euthanized. The Bronx, Philadelphia, Central Park zoos had elaborate plans in the event that the zoos were bombed. Elephants were chained down at night, large cats locked into steel and concrete cages. Keepers were trained to shoot at, they were trained at a local police armory and issued rifles to shoot dangerous animals if the zoo was bombed. Staten Island Zoo ordered that all animals be destroyed in their cages if any enemy planes were spotted. Citizens in Washington, D.C. expressed concern regarding lions and bears and poisonous snakes if the city was bombed, and the zoo director assured them that he had, quote, oiled up a shotgun, and that it was too cold for the poisonous snakes to move around outside their terrariums. He had traded most of the venomous snakes, though, in the collection rather than put them to death. Women entered the zoos in huge numbers for the first time, became zoo workers during the war, another interesting fact. So Soviet zoo directors, they wrote these periodic history of their zoos, and the war years are no exceptions. I have a bunch of stories here that I'll skip in the interest of time. Sort of the history of feeding animals in the 18th century, keeping elephants alive, claiming that he consumed 33 and a quarter buckets of white wine and 53 buckets of water on his trip to Petersburg. There was recently, December 2012, like two elephants from the Polish circus, Jimmy and Magda, their trailer caught fire outside of Novosibirsk, and they too were kept alive with vodka diluted in warm water, and only their ears were frostbitten, and their keeper had severe frostbite. So maybe there's something to it. So I'm going to skip some of the other issues that I go through, which are some of the other problems with the zoos is that, as one biologist, Heine Heidegger, who wrote really, really interesting works on zoos in the 50s and 60s, he said that zoos act like a magnet for all kinds of sadistic behavior. Randy Malamud, who has a book called Against Zoos, he's against the zoos, says sadism by spectators is a facet of the operational status quo at zoos. And that's something, too, I hadn't really thought about. But incredible sadism, incredible cruelty goes on all the time in zoos. And why do we have them? Like, why is this like some, and it's so well hidden, right, by these organizations, and how did it get to this point? I'm going to skip some of the details about the leading up to World War II. I want to talk a little bit about the Soviet example. So Leningrad Zoo, as I said, was during the Second World War and today located in the absolute heart of the city, across from St. Peter and Paul Fortress, with a view of the Winter Palace, on just 10 acres of land. Some kind of menagerie had occupied this space since August of 1865. And even before 1917, zoo directors or those who were working on this in this area asked for more space. They wanted to move. They were asking for a larger space, not next to a fortress and an artillery base. In the Soviet period, this doesn't change, and Soviet directors are couching their entreaties in ideologically appealing way. They say that on May Day and other socialist holidays, the zoo gets so crowded that people can't really enjoy themselves. And in 1939, Leningrad Zoo was finally given a larger territory further out, about 10 kilometers away at Udielnaya. But the move was stalled because they didn't have the money to build the new facilities. They're still waiting to move. They're still there. And each zoo submitted an annual report at the end of each year on the current state of the zoo. The yearly report from the Leningrad Zoo for 1940 was much like the years before. It began with the typical stated goals of the socialist zoo, to popularize among the toilers a material worldview, they use the word Weltanschauung, to promote an understanding of the development of the animal world among socialist citizens, and to acquaint them with biology, the role of animals in the socialist economy. And these were relatively early days of zookeeping. So there's very little distinction made between animal preservation and economic use, right? And that's still the case today, not just in Russia. So you're reading documents where they're like, this is great because we're breeding tons and tons of rabbits to line gloves for the Air Force, right? And so the zoo is really a place of a lot of death. And that's a kind of interesting fact as well. In 1940, they had 25 pavilions. Only three were made of stone: the lion enclosure, antelope enclosure, and the polar bear pavilion. Six were wooden, and the remaining 16 were described as light temporary structures. They pointed out that the majority of their structures were in terrible condition because they thought they were going to move, so they were waiting, and they'd only been doing light upkeep for the last 10 years. Heating and ventilation was a problem. If the weather dipped in the winter, which it tends to do in Leningrad, tropical animals were in danger of dying. They talked about how did they justify their existence. They say, we work, our animals work. We give lectures, we give tours, we do exhibitions, we go to orphanages, we go to schools. And they said, we provide animals for children to ride. But in 1940, this service was in a, quote, critical state because only one pony was fit for this kind of work. The other animals were so old that they weren't up to it. So they go through this. And why am I telling you about Leningrad in 1940? I wanted to establish the conditions at the zoo for animals as not being ideal going into the Second World War. Second, I wanted to draw your attention to what aspects of studying zoos I suspect will be revealing for the historian, right? Among them, the zoo, how it angles for support, right? How it couches itself, how it presents itself, how it lobbies for resources, as I said at the beginning. On one hand, it emphasized that it takes socialism very seriously, and it takes its role in educating the Soviet masses about biology, animals, and evolution. At the other hand, it says, we make money, right? We can support ourselves. We are not simply a drain on the state. They had 1.2 million visitors in 1940. All right, 28th of June, 1941, Leningrad City Soviet gives the zoo permission to evacuate most of the valuable animals to the city of Kazan. 14 members of the zoo staff accompany the evacuation. Despite the fact that the train was shelled, it arrived in Kazan on the 7th of July, 1941, where a filiale of the Leningrad Zoo was established in Kazan. They lost animals along the way. The first casualty was a crocodile. Interestingly enough, there's not a lot of information on what exactly befell the crocodile en route. And my suspicion and some rumors are that you really don't want an unhappy crocodile in a train car. It really is probably rather challenging to deal with. And rumors are that the crocodile was released into the Volga to give it a chance. So yeah, that would be a surprise, right? You go out to fish in the morning, and how do you explain that, you know? There might be some interesting court cases along the way where someone's like, you know, wife has disappeared. I swear this large animal came out of the water, and, you know. Okay, so then it's so interesting, again, to look at the way, like, you get this sort of keyhole view into relations on the ground that we wouldn't necessarily think about, right? Because the Leningrad filiale sets itself up, the local zoo in Kazan's like, we're not sharing resources with you, right? And a bitter struggle begins between the Leningrad animals that have arrived to Kazan and the Kazan zoo over food and shelter. So starting in February 1942, animals at the Kazan zoo began to starve because there was a shortage of grain. The director of the Leningrad filiale had written a note to the Kazan director that he would repay a loan of grain in the fall. And in the summer, the Leningrad Zoo workers had plowed 25 acres of land, and they gave 5 acres to the Kazan Zoo. Except the Kazan Zoo people had a car, so they could harvest the grain and take it back to feed their animals, but they wouldn't share the car with the Leningrad people. So their animals were starving. And when Leningrad couldn't pay their debt, The Kazan Zoo swept in and seized their metal basin that the swans swam in, a portrait of Lenin, and a portrait of Stalin as partial prepayment for the debt. So the Leningrad filial at that point starts to do lectures for money, sell flowers, sell books. They had to pay rent to Kazan. They stopped paying rent, and they longed to come back to Leningrad. When they get the go-ahead to come back, the train is shelled on the way back, and they disappear. So in Leningrad, July 1941, the prisoners who posed a serious danger in the event of their escape were destroyed at the Leningrad Zoo, the ones that remained behind. Lions, bears, wolves were shot. A worker from the zoo remembers, quote, "It was a bright, warm day, and we, as usual, arrived to the zoo to see our loved ones in pools of blood. It was our first traumatic impression of war. However, this measure was necessary. We still did not know how close the enemy would get and how it was possible to bomb and strafe Leningrad." So for 871 days, Leningrad was surrounded, right? Cut off from the rest of the country. Not surprisingly, I could not find a director's report for the zoo for 1941. For 1942, that report is as harrowing a document as you can possibly imagine. The night of September 8th to 9th, the zoo is hit directly by three phosphorus bombs. The first destroyed the entrance to the zoo, another destroyed the primate house, killing some of the inhabitants, injuring others, and the remainder started tearing around the entire area in utter terror. The third bomb hit next to the, this is the primate house. The third bomb hit the elephant house, mortally wounding the elephant Betty, who had been at the zoo since 1911 and was much loved in elephants. There's a whole interesting story about elephants in zoos. You may have seen recent cases where they're trying to get elephants out of zoos because it is very, very painful for elephants to walk on asphalt for decades. They are big and their joints hurt. And so elephants in zoos are pretty horrendous. But all through the 1950s, there's a campaign across the US, like a penny for an elephant. Little kids are raising money to get an elephant for their local zoo. So elephants are very much, they sort of develop a relationship with the zoo clientele and are very much like personalities, both for the people who work there and for people who visit. It's so strange. Again, this animal, eyewitnesses say it took her 48 hours to die and that they could hear her cries across the river. And why let her suffer for 48 hours, right? Given that they shot the animals just a few months earlier, they shot a whole number of animals. And again, it comes back to these contradictions, right? 88 animals die in this raid. The zoo's guard dies. The son of a zoo worker dies. And the zoo's clock closed for one day only. And this was part, again, of their justification for their existence, while the staff gathered the bodies of the animals and cleaned up the territory. And there's really, zookeepers are hesitant to say we fed these animals to the surviving animals. But there's one sort of vague reference I found from the director that this is what happened. So what first struck me about the report of 1942 is what it said about people working at the zoo, right? They coped through the absolute worst winter of the siege by attempting to maintain the normal routines of life at the zoo, by focusing their energy on securing the survival of as many animals as possible. And it's the efforts that went into saving these animals really highlight this fraught and inconsistent attitude we have, right? Why preserve them at all when to do so seems to be prolonging their torment? Why preserve them when hundreds of thousands of Leningraders are starving to death, right? And the zoo continues, and it continues to justify its existence as a socialist zoo. It remains open to visitors through the war. All of its departments continue to function. What they do is they gather the remaining animals into the hippopotamus enclosure, into the begemotic, and they create a small area heated by wood. They plant lettuce, radishes, and onions, keep the animals alive, And of course, it keeps them alive too, right? And I don't think this is purely altruistic at all, right? And it becomes this really interesting situation where the zoo becomes this siege within the siege, right? And I haven't found evidence that people are raiding it, trying to get the animals for food. I haven't found anything like that. And that's, I find, really, really interesting. They move all the animals into the space in the winter. They breed rabbits to keep themselves alive. They claim they're still doing scientific research. They are still going to orphanages. Through this city that's being bombed, they're taking animals to hospitals and orphanages, right? I've got some more details on that, but I know I will be running out of time soon. These are the temporary cages at Leningrad Zoo. They asked, at the end of the 1942 report, they said, the cages need floors and roofs. We need more areas for planting food. We need chlorine and other chemicals to fight a constant infestation of worms and other infections. We need firewood to keep everyone alive. And the greatest demand for firewood came from Krasavica. This is Beauty. Her name in Russian, Krasavica. She arrived in St. Petersburg in 1911, and she was 3 or 4. By the end of the 1930s, she was the biggest female hippo in Europe. And the Berlin Zoo kept trying to buy her, right? Because they had the biggest male hippo in Europe. And zoos were all about breeding, and now they're all about breeding these purebred lines. At the time, they were all about like just making more animals for more zoos, right? So biggest hippo, two biggest hippos, make more big hippos, right? Leningrad Zoo is like, absolutely not. She's not leaving. And for many years, her keeper was the man in the background here, Ivan Antonov. But it was his daughter, Yevdokia Dashina, who saved Krasavica in the war. That's Dashina and Krasavica immediately after the war. Apparently, a hippopotamus that size requires 40 kilograms of food a day. During the war, the main ingredient in her rations was sawdust. So they boiled it until it boiled down to 36 kilograms of like mush. And then they added 4 kilograms of oil cake, bran, vegetables, and some bread. And they needed 400 liters of water a day to keep her skin moist. Because if you don't keep hippopotami moist, their skin will crack, and eventually they will like literally bleed to death. Like they will just die this slow, miserable death because their skin dries out, they have to stay wet. So Dashina, every day, goes down to the Neva, luckily it's close, right? And she hauls back 400 liters of water over the course of the day to keep the pouring this on the hippopotamus, because her pond had been bombed and couldn't hold water anymore, like her tank. And they also needed, that water had to be warm. You can't put cold water on hippopotamus. So you need the firewood to warm the water as well. So she's eating a bunch of wood, using wood to keep, and nothing against Krasavica, right? Like, I'm not passing judgment here. It's just so interesting, right? The resources that are devoted to this. Twice a day, Dashina has to boil all this water, rub her down, oil her skin with seal oil or camphor, so it's okay for seals to die for Krasavica. And given her size, it takes a really long time to bathe and oil her. So often, apparently, shelling would occur while this was happening. And one of the official history of the Leningrad Zoo says, like all frightened hippos, Beauty's instinct was to head for the water. And although her pool was dry, she stubbornly waded in it, lay on the bottom, and groaned. Dashina climbed in there with her and tried to comfort her. So I think I'll probably stop there. I've got more stories. I've got, if you want to hear the story of the tiger and the dog. This tiger, this tiger was a cub at the zoo, so they didn't send him to Kazan with the big cats because he was still a little baby. And to keep him alive, they put him in with a litter of puppies that this dog's mom had had. So these two grew up together, nursing from the same dog, which is why they can be together in an enclosure, and they were buddies. And this goes on at the Moscow Zoo. In fact, there's a children's story written about about a lion who's raised by in a litter of puppies at the Moscow Zoo becomes this very, very famous children's story. And so there's so much that just has come to light through looking at these kinds of materials, and it's just been a very, very exciting project to be working on. So I'll just stop there. Thank you for listening.